Good afternoon, everyone. My name is John Griffin. I'm the faculty director for the Conference on World Affairs. Thanks for being here today. Before this session begins, I just wanted to take a moment to share with you why I work for the Conference on World Affairs and why I support it financially. And in short, one of the reasons I support the conference is that it gives us more opportunities to speak to one another in conversation, which is important for the civic life of this community. I'm sure that many of you feel similarly about the value of the conference to the CWA, and so I hope that you'll join me in supporting the conference this year. You may have seen posters around this building and others on campus that encourage you to help the CWA thrive. That's our motto this year. And as you leave today's panel, I hope that you will consider making a contribution to the conference. You can do that by picking up a donation envelope at the information desk or through our app or on our website. I hope that you will give what you can to support the conference, and I hope that you enjoy today's session. Thank you.
Well, good afternoon. My name is Paul Repetto. I'll be your moderator. This is a panel on concussions called Concussion Discussion. We have a terrific panel. Sitting immediately to my left is Chris Borland. Chris played athletics all his life. In fact, we're going to refer to one of those early experiences. But played football at University of Wisconsin in Madison and then played for the 49ers and then became interested and disturbed by the repetitive hitting that takes place in football and what the effect on the human body is, and left football and since has been an advocate, an activist for further discussion and awareness of the concussion problem. Sitting next to him is Shirav Poda, who is on the other side of that coin in that he is responsible for sports medicine at Anschutz and is very well aware from the physician side of the problems of concussion. For myself, I played sports since grade school and through college. But got interested in concussions because the University of Cincinnati's Children's Hospital had kept a record over 10 years where of 3,898 young children who came into the emergency room with head injuries. One of the things that they recorded was what sport were they playing, and no surprise, you know, football took first place, but there was a surprise, at least for me, that soccer took second place, that supposedly nonviolent sport that we all play. So working with Danny Sanchez, who's the CU soccer coach, he and I agreed that if there were to be a change in soccer, one of the changes might likely be to eliminate those huge, long, half-field and longer goal kicks that the goalies deliver to clear the ball from their zone. We charted some games in Division I and found out there's around 40 per game, and 94% of those are headed. Or in other words, a one-pound missile comes and hits your head after having traveled about 50 yards. So we changed the rules of the game for all of the spring games, all the Division I coaches in Colorado. And for those spring games, the goalie had to clear the ball not by kicking, but by passing to a teammate by hand. Afterwards, Catherine Harding, who's here, who is a CU faculty member, devised a study where we interviewed all of those girls and found out their reactions to the game and so on and so forth. But tucked in there was a question of, have you ever had a concussion? And it turned out that 56% of the young women in the games self-reported having a concussion. So I think maybe a place to begin, since I know that Chris's first concussion came in eighth grade playing a soccer game. So maybe, Chris, the first question is, here are young women playing soccer and 56% say they've had a concussion. Is that an outrageous number? Is that common in sports or what?
No, I don't think it's outrageous. And in fact, I think maybe participants aren't equipped to answer the question. A lot of kids, even to today, think of a concussion as being knocked out, as vomiting. But the symptoms can be as subtle as acute nausea, tinnitus, which is ringing of the ears, disequilibrium. So I think it's important that when you ask these questions, not to say, hey, have you been concussed? Because up until even when I was playing at San Francisco when I started out, if you'd asked if getting my bell rung was a concussion, I would have said no. I've had two diagnosed concussions, and I've never once reported a concussion. The only reason I was diagnosed with two was I was knocked unconscious in eighth grade, and in 10th grade, on a hit on kickoff caused a fumble and was concussed, and I'm stumbling off the field pointing the wrong way as I'm celebrating. So a little too obvious to avoid that taking me off the field for the medical staff. So no, I don't think the number's outrageous. I think it may actually be higher when you look at the acute symptoms. And it's important that when we ask these questions to young people, they fully understand what a concussion is, because it's still ambiguous to a lot of people.
Sure, go ahead.
Chris, I think as you bring that up, the definition of concussion, and think about what we're speaking of here is the subset of sports-related concussion. There's concussions, and if you look at what causes concussion, probably motor vehicle accidents, falling off your bike, living your life. But as we talk about sports-related concussion, which has brought wonderfully, I think, awareness of this entity, and you get away from, hey, I got my bell rung. I played soccer for many years, and we didn't really have medical staff most of our games when I was growing up. And thinking back, if I had a definition of concussion, might have diagnosed myself, maybe. One of the challenges we have also is, you think about some of the symptoms that you mentioned, headache, ringing in your ears. A lot of these symptoms have potentially other causes. And so really grasping, and I think that's where some of the challenges when you try to self-report and looking at some of the studies we've had is really getting a medical diagnosis of a concussion. And I think that's important. And as we look at rates, you brought up really interestingly football. We hear about football, and we had this discussion. Football's a multi-billion dollar industry, pro football in this country, and I think college football at the Division I level, as you see the TV money coming into the sport, has become what some people might say a business. But from a medical standpoint, my job over the last decade, in some regards, has become easier, and some regards has become much more challenging. There's much more awareness. And so we are seeing a trend now of people and athletes becoming more aware of concussion and being more willing to seek out care. It's still a challenge, though. It still is a challenge. And I think as we go forward in studies, and there's a wonderful study that's currently being done, in combination with the NCAA and DOD through a care consortium. The Pac-12 schools are currently in discussion of forming a semi-autonomous hub within this, a regional hub within this consortium. And it's going to be the largest study of its kind in this population. And because we still have a question about what is the natural history of concussion, we're talking about it here like we have a definition. This definition has evolved, right, over time. And I think if you go to different meetings, maybe there's different definitions, all regarding some type of neurometabolic change that happens after a blow. And I think not necessarily to the head, but to the body sometimes. And I think as we go forward, you know, you look at the NCAA data from the last data set, you know, maybe some of you might be surprised, but the highest rate per 10,000 concussions is in wrestling in the NCAA database. The next is men's ice hockey, and then next is women's ice hockey, and then football, and then women's soccer. And so these are all significant, but I think football has really brought that discussion to the forefront and to the table. And I think that's valuable in some regards, as long as we do the right things to continue to study how we're managing these, how we diagnose these, what's the effect of playing a sport. And I think that's a nice discussion that maybe we might have through the course of this session.
Yeah, well, I'm familiar with the work of the NCAA and Department of Defense. I attended a conference a couple of years ago where your colleague Don Comstock was presenting. And that while those rates are accurate, it's missing an important word, reported. I had two diagnosed concussions, and I didn't report the dozen others that were of that similar severity. And it's impossible to report the thousands of subconcussive hits that you incur throughout your career. I think in ice hockey, Wisconsin's got a pretty good program, men and women's. I've got friends that have post-concussion syndrome. I'm well familiar with it. University of Wisconsin Medical College is involved in the same Department of Defense NCAA collaboration. Those hits tend to be at a higher velocity. And so you're going 20 miles per hour on the ice and get a concussion. Maybe it's more severe and you can't help but report it. In football, play 75 snaps a game at middle linebacker in the Big Ten, you'll hit your head 40 times a game. Maybe not at the G-force that hockey players experience, but if I had reported all of the symptoms every time they happened to me in my Big Ten career, at least every week, oftentimes in practice, it happens all the time. So the reporting issue is really complicated and nuanced. I hesitate to trust statistics I see that say there's been X amount of concussions because I've lived it, and I've had two diagnosed while I've had, you know, eight times as many. At least. So I take it with a grain of salt. I think they're doing tremendous work, and it's a step in the right direction, but I hesitate to laud the effort until we get a better way of diagnosing it, a more objective way, perhaps in the future a blood test, something other than someone who is concussed self-reporting. Take a second to consider that. How do you trust the opinion of someone whose cognitive function is not operating appropriately?
There's been a great deal of talk in sports about education of coaches, education of the medical personnel that work with teams. This is clearly a positive step. Whether it's a sufficient step, what do you feel about that, Sherrod?
Oh, I think that's, you know, it comes back to awareness, right? So our sports medicine curriculum, you know, we have fellows, doctors who come and train with us and train at programs across the country, and that's part of the curriculum is in sports medicine is concussion management awareness. I agree with you, Chris. You know, you look at what we do to manage concussion, and most concussions are not straightforward. It's not you running the wrong way, and it's pretty obvious. Most concussions can be subtle, and again, based on symptoms that can have other potential etiologies or causes. If we really look at the progression of how we manage concussion, one part of our Venn diagram is symptoms. We follow symptoms, and we're dependent on the patient or student athlete in this case to self-report symptoms. Well, there's also a cognitive battery, and then there's also a balance battery, and there's also a neuropsych battery. And so what we're trying to do, and there's, you know, more recently we're looking at vestibular ocular motor screening as part of our battery. And so really as we look And this is really the wonderful thing that's going forward, you know, how we manage things now, and this is a good sign, I think, very different over the last several years. You know, each year, our team, our athletic trainers, and all our team physicians, we get together, and there's a concussion protocol that gets submitted to the NCAA, and this has been the last couple of years. So what do? We sit down each year, we look at the current science, and we evolve, and that's required at all our all the Power Five conferences, at least. And so there's a process in place. Is it perfect? I don't think so, right? But as long as there's a process, just like as we live our life and as we pursue science, there's a process. Here's our information that we know currently. Do we just give up and say, okay, well, we know everything? This is one of those fields where there's evolving data. And I'm really encouraged by everything that I learn every month when I get my email battery of, okay, well, here's the newest science and what are the studies? And so it helps me keep up. You know, we discuss that in journal clubs with our fellows and our residents that we train. And I think that awareness that has been brought will hopefully continue to help us manage things better and as the science evolves.
So concussion is referred to often as a treatable disease. And we have people have come at it from two different sides, the recipient and the treater. To what extent is that true? And what are the steps that are taken in treating a discussion? Maybe that needs to. Treating a concussion. But is it treatable?
So you know, the hallmark, and we've got colleagues who've done some wonderful work around the country and internationally who have figured out maybe some of the neurometabolism of what happens with a concussion. You know, there's changes in ion fluxes and changes in glucose metabolism. And so there is a concept of a period of a vulnerable window. And I think that the variables in that are dynamic, you know, depending on what sport you play, what history you bring to the table as an individual, how many concussions you've had in the past, do you have a learning disability, do you have a other diagnosis of ADHD, do you have any underlying family history of mental health issues. Those are all the variables as a clinician, as we look at and we call the modifiers, as we're looking and managing concussions. I think one thing that I find very valuable and think about as a role as a team physician is I love to get to know our athletes. You know, we do our pre-participation physical, and one of my favorite things to do, and happens every year at graduation, I see a couple of our football players in back there, is I see the evolution, and when you graduate from when you come in, and Chris, you went through this, we grow up in college. It's a really unique point in time, and it's a wonderful, wonderful age group to work with. It's a developing brain at the same time. And so when we look at management of concussion, we are continuing to is it treatable? Here's what I would say. I would say the majority, you know, 90% of sports-related concussion, which is typically, you know, you're not getting hit by a car, although maybe when Chris was playing his playing days, as people he was tackling might have thought otherwise, but the velocities that are involved can be significant, but most of these are self-related and self-contained entities. One of the fields that I think that we are continuing to try to understand is this concept of just playing the game. You know, the subconcussive blows where you don't achieve that threshold where we're doing a battery of tests on the sideline and gosh, you know what? Everything checks out pretty good. How do we figure out what that threshold is? And again, it's a very much of an individualized decision. And I think those variables that are being studied currently is that's what we're trying to figure out.
Chris, when you had your concussions, did you ever receive what you would consider to be treatment at the time other than just coming out of the game?
Well, my first one in eighth grade was in the early 2000s, so I was jogging on the sidelines trying to go back in, got dizzy, and they didn't let me go back in, thankfully, and went to the hospital for that one. Sophomore year, I did sit out a week at the time. Rest was thought to be the absolute best thing. I know the DOD and NCAA are thinking otherwise now. And then in college, you know, I always played through concussions. So it's a moot point. I will say, I'm not a physicist or a mathematician, but the G-force when you run for 40 yards at 20 miles per hour at 250 pounds and run into three guys running 10 miles per hour for 15 yards at 300 pounds is a car wreck. It just is. The G-force involved is a car wreck, and it happens. That's an instance of a kickoff I just represented, but at linebacker on lead plays, on power plays, I see football players shaking their head. Yeah, you know. When a team comes out in goal line and they're in 22 personnel, which means they got all their big bodies out there, and you play middle linebacker and there's an inch to score a touchdown or not, and you meet in the hole, you know, I played at 245 with my pads on. I was probably 260, and I'm meeting Ohio State's fullback who's 275 with pads on, 290, and it's as hard as you can run, and you meet in a space that's the size of a phone booth. That's unavoidable. Most teams are balanced. Most teams run the ball about 50% of the time and throw it 50% of the time. So that happens 40 times a game and in practice. For all the follies that the NFL's had, one thing that they've done well, in my opinion, is reduce the amount of contact in practice. We can talk about rule changes. We can talk about equipment. We can talk about culture. The most sensible and immediately achievable goal in my mind is just to reduce the amount of times that you hit your head. It's painfully obvious, and I think we're at a point where there is enough information where we should follow the lead. I hesitate to say this, but follow the lead of the NFL. it makes no sense that guys who aren't being paid at the college, high school, and youth level hit more often than the guys who are making $1 million to play.
Right. The Ivy League, for example, as you know, they eliminated hitting in all practices in football. So the hitting occurs 100% of the time in games, and the rest of the time, no hitting. At the other end of the spectrum, the heading has been eliminated in soccer. Checking has been youth soccer. Checking has been eliminated in youth hockey. So, you know, there are things happening on both sides of that, both ends of that spectrum. So what does a parent do? Does a parent ask their children to avoid sports or some sports? Does a parent instead, at the other end, learn as much as possible about concussions and how to detect them and assure that there's teaching involved? But how does a parent think about this if they have children that are interested in sports?
I can take it if you want.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's oftentimes a false dilemma presented where either we have youth tackle football or these kids have no place to get to glean these lessons. I didn't play football until high school. My little brother never played football. He's a great guy. There's a million ways to learn lessons. Football's a uniquely American activity in large part. There's great football played in Canada and elsewhere, but it's an American sport. I think Japanese children learn a lot of lessons absent youth tackle football. I think young Italian boys do too. Paul mentioned the measures they've taken in hockey and soccer. Football's kind of the odd man out now, for obvious reasons. It's a core of the game. You can take checking out and still have hockey. You can take heading out and still have soccer. You can't take blocking schemes and run fits and contact out of football and have it still be football. So we were talking backstage, and I mentioned there's probably not a lot of kids that play the three combinations of sports, but how confusing it must be if in the winter you play hockey and you can't check, because we're trying to protect your brain. In the spring and summer, you play soccer and you can't head the ball because we're trying to check your brain. But Billy, go ahead and hit your head 500 times this fall. It just doesn't make sense to me.
I think at the NCAA, there's been evolution in contact rules. And so just this year, so in preseason, there's been quite an awareness, I think, you know, in the medical community about this question about subconcussive blows and exposures. And so I give credit to the NCAA. They put together a panel and multi-association summit and really look at, hey, how do we model this? You know, we're playing a game, there's rules, but how do you modify some of those rules? And then how do you modify the contact? And there's, you know, we haven't had 2 days. There's new rules. There's no 2 days during preseason camp. There's limitations in live contact and tackle to the ground and what we call thud. And so it's interesting. It's from a medical professional standpoint. I mean, I'm not a coach, but it's been wonderful to see the awareness. As awareness is built and as the data has started to come out, that there's been some effort. You know, it's as we were mentioning before, it's like moving an ocean liner a little bit, right? And you can't turn it on a dime. But as when we use data-driven decisions, and that's really what we want to do, it's I think the caution is to use emotion to drive decisions. And it's as a scientist and as a medical professional, when I'm counseling patients, I always like to go back to the data and you know, what's the evidence behind this? Why should we do this? And then in a shared decision-making process, and hopefully you have very similar interactions with your personal physicians, in a shared decision-making process, how do we come together and find a route that's meaningful in an individualized manner that provides the treatment or prevention, in some cases, that's desired? And I think that's really the hallmark and key. We always say, as data's coming around, we get these genetic, well, here's this genetic marker, and if you've got this gene, then maybe you're more susceptible to symptoms following a head injury. And, and this is not based on science, but conjecture, as you go forward, you think about a time where you get you go to ancestry.com and you figure out where your ancestors are from, and might there be a panel where, hey, this individual might be at higher risk to play certain types of sport, whereas this individual might be fine and can withstand, you know, similar to cancer. There's all these, you know, if you have seven different boxes you got to check before you get cancer, if you're born with three checks already, gosh, you're going to be at a higher risk. If you're born with no checks, you could maybe have five checks and not get cancer and pass away and live a long, healthy life. And I think that's really what we're trying to figure out. You know, those are where the studies are trying to evolve and understand is how do we do things? I think there's some great people around the country and around the world that are really looking at this and hopefully in making decisions going forward in a data-driven manner. And I think that's really the key as we look at this from a medical standpoint.
Go ahead, Chris.
Well, I agree. I think data is really important, and it's vital to be objective and remove emotion from the conversation. I have to admit, when I first started looking into this, I was hugely biased towards football. My whole objective when I was reading about things from Boston University and the Mayo Clinic and the NFL themselves, the NCAA at University of Michigan, UCLA, was to say they're full of shit. I thought Boston University was blowing this up. I thought at the time that Chris Nowinski, who's the founded the Concussion Legacy Foundation and works in conjunction with Boston University studying the brains of former contact athletes, I thought he was trying to sell books and make a name for himself. To me, it became apparent with my experience also that there was a lot of data, convincing data, that ultimately changed my mind. After I had quit, there was a study at the Mayo Clinic, and released in December of 2015, that took athletes from a variety of sports, male and female, and amateur athletes, high school and college, and it found that a third of them had CTE pathology, which is a unique brain disease. The control group, 198 brains, there were zero cases. Zero. So I'm not really incredulous about causality. For me, as a guy trying to help people in need, I don't have the luxury of time. I've got guys texting and calling and emailing needing help today. And so I'm not trying to disparage the fine work of the NCAA and Department of Defense and others. But to me, the aid that's needed is immediate. The answers may take 50 years, but it's kind of telling the fact that I'm busy helping people, so much so that I can't really participate in the conversation.
The I have a question here that is one that has certainly never occurred to me on the subject. And the question is whether jogging, the repetitive up and down, say, of running on a hard surface, has that ever been known to produce concussion-like symptoms or indeed concussions, period?
Going back to data, I can't. I won't quote you a study. You know, maybe one thing that as we discuss this, because this is a wonderful conversation, right? I think as we think about society and we think about what our evolution of our health status, and I have this great slide that one of my colleagues has. He gives a talk on obesity, and he goes back 50 years and he looks at obesity rates in our country, and you know it goes from white to purple, and white is we've got a normal population with a low incidence of obesity. As our obesity rates grow up, and the reason I bring this up, that whole map in his last talk was purple because this state was the last one that turned purple, which is we've got high rates of obesity. But the reason I bring that up is that as we think about sport and activity, and I think Paul, you brought up, what do we tell our kids? Sport is good, activity is good, and I think I hope that's not the message, is that hey, we should all be playing Xbox and not go outside and enjoy ourselves and put ourselves in a bubble because we're worried about hitting our head. And I think sport has a lot of value. Sport has, we both got a lot out of the sports that we play. It helps you learn how to work with others, make yourself better. And so that being said, how do we make the game that we play, the games that we play, safer? And I think that's really needs to be the question. And I think there's again, good work, and it's wonderful. I was telling Chris earlier, we had the privilege of kind of doing a little short radio interview, and the process that he went through, I admire. Here's a guy who was on a all-pro trajectory on his rookie contract to this was meaningful enough for him where he made a personal decision to walk away. Think about times in our lives where we have opportunities and you come to those fulcrums and make a decision based on something meaningful. That's really telling.
Well, Chris, you've had some experience with this in your advocacy work. But one of the interesting questions here, it says, are entities like CU and others facing liability questions? And you could take that down to coaches of younger teams and professional teams. But is there liability involved here in some way that hasn't cropped up yet?
Sure. Well, not to feign expertise on the issue, but there is a concussion settlement from a lawsuit in the NFL where nearly a third of players were named in it. And there's been class action suits in the NCAA as well. The interesting thing about the NFL settlement, and I don't know everything about it, and I'm not named in it or anything, is that it contains language that excludes players from suing the NFL for CTE symptoms for the next 60 years. So at one moment, they're admitting a causal relationship and in the same text, denying it. Again, that's one of those things that makes you scratch your head. The variable of time is the crux of the problem for me to this. The NFL is a $14 billion a year industry. The players who are afflicted with issues caused from their time in the NFL are desperate for help immediately. That's a huge leverage point for the NFL in the settlement. So they can afford to kick the can down the road, and payments aren't what they're advertised to be. Players will not get as much as you think they will. And cost for things like ALS, which is named in the suit, and cost for things like dementia and Alzheimer's is extremely high. I think if they set aside money that maybe annually or put it in a pool, could do something and have it built in for players. But like you said, it's about liability. The NFL can survive it. The NCAA can survive it. I don't know when cases come up at the youth level, how they survive it.
There are a number of questions here that all sort of gather up in one area, and that is, once an individual has had a concussion, is that individual more sensitive to having additional concussions, or is each time a one-time independent event?
So there's a saying that we use is, if you've seen a concussion, you've seen one concussion, and these are all individual entities. That being said, once you've had a concussion, you know, there's this concept of in the immediate setting, a vulnerable window where there needs to be a sufficient amount of time and resources that are put into play before an athlete is returned to play, and that's important. And again, I like data, so there was a study from 2001 in the NCAA, which is much smaller than the one that's currently underway, and average return to play was, after a concussion in football at that time, was 6.7 days. With this current data, and with multiple sports, the average return to play is 14.3. That we've seen in that last iteration, which was presented in January at UCLA. And so I think part of that is just awareness of what's going on, and there's probably, again, evolving management issues with that. I do think, Paul, if there was a point in your question, and if you can remind me that as you were saying it, I said, oh, I should address that, but...
Well, if you get one, do you have a better chance of getting two?
So, right. There, I think you can say that once, if you've had one, that potentially you're more likely to have another concussion. I think the question is, and this is the individual one of the million-dollar questions is, how many? What's too many? I don't think we know this answer. I think we're trying to figure this out. You know, if you have three concussions and your symptoms resolve and you get back to full cognitive function and the battery of tests that we know to do now and that we're adding, and you never have another concussion, is that okay? Or and you're back within 10, 14, 16 days. Now, with each, the red flags that I talk about is that with each subsequent concussion, if that return to play becomes longer and longer and longer, then I think that's a red flag. And I think there needs to be a discussion about how many is too many in those cases.
Yeah, and I'd like to add to that. This is titled the concussion discussion, but I think there's an interplay between repetitive brain injury and concussion. And it's not a matter of semantics. I think it's a very real issue. Can you have a concussion and recover and be fine? Yes. Do we know what happens when you have a concussion and hit your head 1,000 times a year playing Division I football or NFL football and have another and your brain blood barrier is compromised and leaky? And I don't know that we have those answers, but it's a pursuit that's really important. If we just looked at concussions, I don't think we'd answer the questions. I think it's imperative that the conversation includes those repetitive hits, albeit subconcussive.
There's a... one of the questions here says, is there any, the CTE examination, which is usually, in fact, always, so far as I know, done upon death because it's the only time you can do it. But is that true? And is it likely to remain true? Or will there likely be ways to assess this growing damage that you're referring to in one way or another without having to die to figure it out?
I'll let the doctor take that one.
So, you know, when we think about CTE, it slips off the tongue now, right? CTE, it's easy to say, right? So chronic traumatic encephalopathy, if you really look at it, it's a real entity, right? There's a neuropathophysiologic basis that's been described. Unfortunately, as Paul mentioned, there's not a test. I don't think any one of us would volunteer to have our brain biopsied right now while we're sitting here to figure out if we have these plaques at the base of our sulci. There's a lot of crossover with a lot of other neurodegenerative findings. We've Alzheimer's and other type of neurodegenerative conditions. And so right now, the classification of CTE is really a path of, when I say pathophysiology, that means we're looking at a slide and we're looking at where these patterns in the brain occur. And so clinically, there's three domains, so to speak, neurobehavioral, motor, and so when we think about these things, you think about the classic, maybe some of us have seen movies with dramatizations of this, and that neurobehavioral, where you're depressed, and you look at the case series, which is a subset population that's been studied in the brain bank at Boston. Very interesting, because I think it's furthered the science in some regards, but it's maybe muddied water from a clinical standpoint, because again, we're looking at case series, and what's the great way to do a study? You get people who are normal and biopsy their brains and see if they have these findings, and you have people who have multiple hits and you biopsy your brains, and you have people who have play contact sports or do an activity or work where they're going to be put in situations where they're going to have additional contact or potential subconcussive injury, and compare that across paradigms. And that's really where the work needs to be done. I think this is an evolving topic. Are you going to get, is Chris going to get CTE? I hope not.
Chris, did you have, there's a question here that concerns symptoms that lasted a while. Did you have trouble sleeping? Did you feel tired over a period of time? What were the continuing, the remnants of having been concussed that you experienced?
Yeah. Well, I'll answer that, but first I'd like to briefly talk about the brain bank, because I think it can be a crux of confusion. Is it a biased sample? Of course. It's former players' families that have donated their brains after they've observed their loved ones exhibiting some strange behaviors. That said, 96% of former NFL players have the pathology. That's an overwhelming statistic, even for a biased sample, and all of these non-medical professionals are diagnosing it rather well by knowing to send their loved one's brain in. Further, there's been enough brains studied where at the very least 10% of deceased NFL players have this disease. And I think the Mayo Clinic study speaks to the fact of comparing that control group of 198 brains with no pathology to the 33% who have it. So of course it's evolving. Of course we've got a lot to learn. To me, the dramatic number of cases, the percentages are so high. We do have instances where we compare it to people who haven't played contact sports. And I don't know that the interpretation of that is banning anything or not playing youth tackle football or not playing youth football in general. I don't think tackle should be played, but it's time enough where we can institute some sensible changes to help lower those numbers. And then even before getting into that, just to share the information. Awareness is high, but I don't know that that's synonymous with quality information. Everyone I've run into the past 2 years will evoke some notion that, well, it's getting a lot better. I don't know. Can we quantify that? The NFL and the NCAA sure like to say that, but I feel like those claims lack data. And if you have the data of it's never been safer, how safe was it? When did you know that it was that dangerous? And how has it improved? Because if you knew in 87 and 94 and 2002 of some of these risks, players played in an era where they were being, the truth was being withheld from them. As far as my symptoms, I've had a few. So emotionally, that's been tough at times. Cognitively, I feel sharp. I test well on the clinical evaluations that I've had at various places. I've had a SPECT scan conducted, which is a 365 degree scan of your brain. Your bloodstream is illuminated with this fluid, and it measures, amongst other things, blood flow. And I have a lack of blood flow in my prefrontal cortex and in my amygdala. So, I think there's enough. I think we can institute some changes. It is an ocean liner. It'll take a lot to change, but I think the information speaks for itself.
All right, we have about 5 minutes left. There are a ton of questions, all of which have to do with football, which I think tends to overshadow the problem of concussion from a wide variety of activities. For example, one of the questions here has to do with skiing, which is a big sport here in Colorado, and there's an awful lot of falling. And another question has to do with diving and swimming and cracking your head, even though you've got your hands out here like this. But is the broader issue of first concussions and second traumatic brain injuries, is that discussion happening, or what would make it happen better?
Well, I played football and I quit football because of brain damage, so I usually just talk about that. It's a worthwhile conversation and an important exploration to look at all variety of sports and to look at everyday life. I don't mean to shirk the importance of that. Oftentimes, I'll hear neurologists at conferences say, well, there's danger in riding your bike. There's danger in going for a walk. There's danger in being obese. The point of riding a bike is not to crash it. The point of diving off a diving board is not to hit your head on the way down. The point of football is violence. So it's not an accident. I don't get in these accidental collisions playing linebacker. It's very purposeful. And I'm sorry, I mean, if this is coming off a little overly intense. I do think the work is beneficial, and it's improved immensely in a short period of time. But frankly, I get tired of those corollaries that are apples and oranges, because it doesn't hold water. And if you can't ride a bike without falling off, you should stop riding a bike. Accidents happen, and if a serious concussion occurs, do the right thing. Get help. Get better. But there's a fundamental difference between those types of activities that it doesn't do the conversation justice to ignore that.
I think I think if you look here, there's a lot of commonality to what we're talking about here with sport activity. As we talk about, Chris, I think brings it up very eloquently. There's a culture, and probably a decade ago that culture was even more dramatic, and 2 decades ago even more dramatic, of not understanding what is a concussion, and part of what we hope going forward, and again, I'm going to go back to data, some of the preliminary data that we found from the CARE Consortium is, and especially when we're talking with athletes as a clinician, this is meaningful, because a lot of times if you hide concussive symptoms, and we've got data on some preliminary data on this now, if you seek care immediately and you want to get back to a sport that you really enjoy playing, what some of this preliminary data is showing is that as you're able to get back maybe 2 days sooner than if you don't present immediately with symptoms and for evaluation, and maybe present at the end of a game or the next day. And those cases, looking at this data set, looks like your return to play is going to be prolonged. And I think that's valuable because that's the million-dollar question. So, you know, you're playing this game. If you – most of the time these concussions are not obvious. And so we – you know, sometimes it'll be, hey, you know what, he's running the wrong route. He's you know, there's – we do the sideline testing and checks out okay. And that's where – from a team physician standpoint, I like to know our athletes because they may answer all my questions correctly, but I know this is not the same person. This is not the guy that I see in the training room walking through. And in those cases, it helps me help them because then we're going to go inside and we're going to do a bigger battery of tests. And if there's any question, and I think that's the culture change, I think, Chris, hopefully that we see going forward, and we will see if that making sports safer using some of these data-driven decisions that are evolving.
Well, thank you, Sherrod, and thank you, Chris. Thank you. This has been really an interesting discussion.